other information. So what you do is you do a consolidated revenue in one currency, you get consolidated cash flows, but you discount them at a discount rate, that's a weighted average of the equity risk rate of the different companies.
Okay, so it's a weighted average.
Exactly.
Okay.
And that's because it's very difficult. You could do it regionally, but then you'd need all the information regionally and companies can provide.
Okay, sounds good. Last question, when we're evaluing our company, do you recommend reading the 10K or the quarterly reports?
You probably need to do both, because the 10K will be as of 2015, and you need the quarterly reports. So I'll go through the process of how to get trained. I've actually put up an interactive webcast on how to combine the 10K and the 10Q to create a training plan.
Okay. And I was just looking, I talked to you about the company that I chose, Valand Class, and their report is like 300 pages.
Yes, sir, that's the nature of the beast, right?
So, like, I was looking at your video, like, how to read the 10K, so that's a way to sort of, like, think about it.
90% of the people use it.
Okay, yeah, exactly. So you recommend to, like, really don't read the whole thing. Thanks a lot.
Get their attention.
Could I have your attention, please?
Go ahead.
Excuse me? My name's Xavier. I'm part of NYU Alternative Breaks, and my particular group is promoting the cause for youth development. So we'll be having our first fundraiser tomorrow at Chipotle on 8th Street, and basically all you have to tell them at the register is that you're there for NYU Alternative Breaks, and half of the purchase will go to our cause, youth development. So it'd be great if you could help us out. Thanks.
Thank you. Okay, so who's not in a group yet? Let's get that out of the way. Everybody's in a group, right? Good. Who's not picked a company yet? No lies. Come on, be honest. Okay, that's not too bad, unless lots of people are lying. The rest of you have picked companies. If I called on you and said, who are you valuing, you'll have a company name. Be honest with yourself. Self-delusion is so easy. So just make sure you pick a company soon, because as you can see, we're getting deeper and deeper into the class. Okay? And tomorrow you'll get your first weekly valuation with an actual company. I won't name the company, but wait for it and start playing with the numbers, because it's going to get you ready for valuing your own company. So what I'd like to start today's class with is a little bit different from the usual start of the class. I'm going to actually make you go back and review some of the stuff we've already done, because it can get a little confusing. Because if you remember, two sessions ago we talked about risk-free rates, right? And what's the rule with risk-free rates? What risk-free rate should you use in evaluation? Depends on what? You're right. Depends on what kind of company and where and how long and what currency, right? Ultimately, all of those, because I could value a Russian company in rubles, or I can value it in dollars, or I can value it in pesos, or I can value it in euros. The risk-free rate will always be in the currency in which you do the valuation, not where the company necessarily is. So risk-free rates, we said, the rule is very simple. Pick a currency, do valuation in that currency. Then we got to equity risk premiums, and I went through that pretty tedious process of coming up with the risk premium for the U.S., and I kind of said up front, no, and I came up with that historical premium that didn't trust the number. It's a strange place to build. But I took that number, and on top of that, I came up with risk premiums for countries. And to get those risk premiums, I started with the default spread for the country, and I built up, and I ended up with a risk premium for countries. And that was a precursor to estimating an equity risk premium for an individual company. So when I want to estimate an equity risk premium for an individual company, I said you need to take a weighted average of all of the countries you operate in, if that information is available, or some regional average. So we ended with examples from Coca-Cola and Royal Dutch to show how that process would play out. So you ready? So here's my first start of the class test. See if you can bring these two concepts together. You're trying to estimate a risk-free rate for a Swiss multinational. It gets 10% of its revenues in Switzerland, Swiss francs, 30% of its revenues in EU in euros, 40% of its revenues in the US in US dollars, and 20% of its revenues in India with Indian rupees. Okay, so it has four different currencies that it gets its cash flows in. The risk-free rates are 0.5% in francs, 1% in euros, 2.5% in US dollars, and 6% in rupees. You have to value this company, and you have to come up with a risk-free rate. What risk-free rate will you use in your valuation? And I'll give you the choices. And if that choice works, you know, put up your hand and say, that's the one that I'd pick. I could use a simple average of the risk-free rates. Take the four numbers, add them up, divide by four. Anybody go for that? That sounds like it's too simplistic, right? How about a weighted average of the risk-free rates? Don't worry, it's okay. Can I call on you, though? Okay. So why did you say weighted average? Because I just confused you when I talked about equity risk premiums and I said you should use weighted averages. And if you can use weighted averages there, why not use weighted averages here? What's the problem taking a weighted average of risk-free rates? Remember the Celsius-Fahrenheit example I gave you? If I ask you what the average temperature is between Chennai and New York, you can't take 30 degrees Celsius and 86 degrees Fahrenheit, add them together and divide by two, because you're going to end up with neither fish nor fowl, neither Celsius nor Fahrenheit. The problem with currencies is they don't belong in the same valuation. So if you decide to value this company, you have to make a choice. And that choice is going to drive, and the choice has to be a currency choice. So you can take all of these revenues and convert them into Swiss francs and get a Swiss risk-free rate as your risk-free rate. Or you can take all of these revenues and convert them into U.S. dollars and use a U.S. dollar risk-free rate. Or convert all of them into Indian rupees and use a rupee risk-free rate. And for the moment, just take my word for it, if you do it right, you should get the same value for the company. Of course, there are lots of ways you can do it wrong because you have all these currencies floating around. So the right answer here is the risk-free rate that you should be using here should be based on the currency in which you do the valuation. And if the valuation is in Swiss francs, the risk-free rate will be the Swiss franc risk-free rate. Not because it's the lowest, it's because you're matching up the currency to your cash flows. So unless you tell me what currency you're going to do the valuation in, I can't even answer this question. So remember that when you sit down to do a valuation, make a choice on currency, convert everything into that currency, do all your valuation in that currency, everything's going to be okay. Let's take a second question. Let's see how much you remember the last class when we talked about historical risk premiums, right? I went back all the way to 1928 or 98 or 2008. I came up with historical premiums for the U.S., so let's assume that you are trying to compute a historical premium. Your challenge is a statistical challenge, right? I've given you the data, and you're saying, what should I be using to come up with a historical premium? So the first question I'm going to ask you is, I could give you 150 years of data, but that includes data from before the Great Depression when the U.S. was an emerging market. So here's my first question. How long a time period should you use to come up with a historical premium? And I'll give you the choices. You can just take last year. Why? It's current. It's updated. You could take the last 5 years. I think it's still current, but at least you get some averaging. You could use as long a time period as you can get the historical data for, 80 years, 100 years, 150 years. Maybe you should match up to whatever the time period for your risk-free rate is. I've seen all of these used in valuation. That's why I've come up with all these choices. And what do we say we use as our risk-free rate? 10-year T-bonds, right? So maybe you should go back only 10 years. We haven't talked about betas yet, but there you'll be asked to make a choice again. How, 2 years of beta? So what do you think the right answer to this question is? How long should you go back? Remember that I said this was a statistical problem, not a financial problem. What's the statistical problem you face? You're trying to compute an average based on data, right? And what do we say that average comes with that you need to watch if this is a statistics class? It comes with a standard error. A one-year number is pure noise. Last week I was at looking over a valuation that somebody had used with a 10-year risk premium for the U.S. The 10-year risk premium they came up with was 6.3%. Doesn't sound unreasonable, right? So I emailed the person and I said, I see that you've used a 10-year premium. Do you know what the standard error on that premium is? He says, what's the standard error? And that, I think, is part of the problem. We forget our statistics when we do finance. That was statistics. We don't do standard errors in finance. Why not? We worry about the same things. You know what the standard error in a 10-year estimate is? It's about 8%. Think about that. When I tell you the risk premium is 6.3%, and then I say, oh, by the way, the standard error in that estimate is 8%, I've told you absolutely nothing. So if you're going to go back with historical data, I'm afraid you have no choice but to go back as far as you can, because you need lots of data to get even the slightest chance of getting that standard error under control. That's why I went all the way back to 1928. I know it was a different market in 1928. I know I'm asking for trouble when I go back that far, but if you force me to do a historical risk premium, I have no choice but to go back as far as I can. Now I have a follow-up question. The risk premium we came up with is 4.62% if I go all the way back to 1928. That's 1928 through 2016. I'm not making any predictions, so don't freak out here, but let's say 2017 is a horrible year for stocks. Remember, I said this is not a prediction. I don't want this flying around on Twitter. De Morton predicts horrible year for stocks. This is a hypothetical, right? I have no idea what's going to happen to stocks. But let's say that stocks drop. It's like 2008. You're in a crisis. Stocks drop 35%. What's going to happen to your historical risk premium on January 1st, 2018? No, wait. This is a mathematical question. So basically what am I doing? I'm adding one extra year of data, right? But that one extra year brings what? A very bad year for stocks and perhaps a neutral or even a good year for bonds. So when I compute the historical premium on January 1st, 2018, rather than going up, what's going to happen to it? It's actually going to go down. And that's part of the problem with historical risk premiums. The reason it's a problem is, why did you say it's going to go up? Exactly. It's a crisis. At the end of a crisis, if I came and said, do you think stocks are more risky? Can you imagine somebody in January 2009 saying, oh, you know what? I think stocks are okay now. I'll demand a smaller risk premium. That doesn't make any sense to me. But because we're looking at a backward-looking estimate, it's actually going to push you in the wrong direction. In years when you feel optimistic, the premium is going to go up. In years when you feel pessimistic, the premium is going to go down. That makes zero no sense to me, but that's the nature of historical premiums. I don't like historical risk premiums. I haven't used one in a valuation in a long time, which actually puts me in a really bad spot, because if I'm not going to look backwards, then the question is, how the heck do you come up with a risk premium to use in valuation? So I'm going to set up a very, very simple example here to illustrate the process by which I'm going to estimate risk premiums. So I need somebody to be my guinea pig again. Okay. Do you want to be my guinea pig? It's very simple. I'll make you look like a genius. Okay. So let's assume that today I come to you with an investment. It's a dollar in cash flows. It's guaranteed. And you're going to get $1 every year forever. How much would you pay for that investment? Just give me a rough estimate. Right now, $1 guaranteed every year forever. It's a perpetuity, okay. No, forever. You get $1 this year, $1 next year, $1 a year after, forever. So if it's a perpetuity, it'll be $1 divided by whatever you'd require as your return. If it's guaranteed, what should you demand as a return on a U.S. dollar investment? Risk-free rate, roughly 2.5%. So 1 divided by 0.025 is about $40. And if you think about why $40 works, if you invest $40 today, what are you going to make next year? You're going to make $1. 1 divided by 40 is 2.5%. So every year you make 2.5%. You think, this is stupid. Why are we even playing this game? Hang in there for just a moment. That's if I gave you a dollar guaranteed every year forever, right? Now, let's suppose I change the parameters of the dollar a little bit. Instead of saying it's going to be a dollar guaranteed every year, let's suppose this dollar is an expected cash flow and that there's uncertainty about what I'll pay you. How much uncertainty? As much uncertainty there is in the equity market, whatever that is. So in your mind, think about how risky the equity market is. So now I've given you a dollar with uncertainty. Would you pay less than $40 or more than $40 for that? Because remember, it's not guaranteed anymore. It was guaranteed, you paid 40. Now that it's not guaranteed, you'd pay less. You want to give me a number? How much would you pay for it? Don't worry, there's no right number. How much? Less than one? Less than 40, obviously, but how much? So just. Okay, anybody want to beat him to that? 35, that's a lot. I would pay probably. Anybody want to go with a lower number? That's a lot. It's a lot of risk now. You're pretty close to 40 still. With a dollar on a 35, you're looking at what, 2.8% return, right, basically? How about $10? I just made it up. $10. When you tell me you pay $10 for this investment, what are you telling me? That you need to make a 10% return on stocks. You see, who cares? How is this going to help us come up with an equity risk premium? Do people pay for cash flows in the equity market every day? Yeah. In fact, when you look at the S&P 500, what are you getting? You're getting what people will pay for the cash flows on stocks, right? So let's set up a game. Let's assume that I take that price you pay, and then I estimate cash flows. It's a little messy because I'm not giving you the dollar guarantee, but let's say I could estimate the expected cash flows on stocks. I could estimate what your expected return will be based on what you pay, and then from that I can back out what your equity risk premium should be. I call this an implied equity risk premium. It sounds really complicated. But you know what I'm doing? I'm stealing from the bond market. In the bond market, when you price a bond, you know what the yield to maturity is? What's the definition of yield to maturity in a bond? It's whatever discount rate will make the present value of the cash flows, the coupon and the face value, equal to the price. In fact, that's how you solve for what? It's like an internal rate of return on the bond, right? I'm going to do something similar with stocks. I'm going to solve for an internal rate of return on stocks. That's going to tell me what people are demanding as an expected return. I'm going to use that to back out what the equity risk premium is for stocks. And I'm going to call it implied because this is not my number. It's not your number. It's what people are pricing the risk of equity to be. That's the opening that I'm going to use to come up with an equity risk premium for the S&P 500. So when you see the numbers, you're going to see this play out. But remember the very simple example I gave you, because that's going to be the easiest way for you to think about what I'm doing. So let's go back to page 60 in the notes. And let me complete that discussion of what to do with equity risk in companies. So I gave you what we generally do. We take a weighted average of the different parts of the world you operate in, weighted by revenues or by production or some combination of the two. And most of the time, 95% of the time, this is how I deal with equity risk. But let's say you have a company that has a single big country risk exposure. It's a company which gets 70% of its revenues in Brazil, and the rest is in the rest of the world. And you're really concerned about that exposure. And you want something more refined, something a little more precise than just taking this weighted average. So I'll tell you the genesis for what you're going to see next. It was about 12 years ago. I was on a trip to Brazil. It was a flight to Sao Paulo, a really long flight. And I couldn't fall asleep. So usually if you catch a flight from New York or JFK, you get on about 6:30. The nice thing about Brazil is there's not much time difference, so you're just flying overnight. So I sit there, I try to fall asleep. This guy in the next seat is oozing into my seat. I just finally give up and say, okay, might as well look over the stuff I've got to do tomorrow. So I pull up the slides that I'm going to use in the next day's session. And I'm going through it. And the two companies I was valuing were Embraer, which is a Brazilian aerospace company, and Ambev, which is a Brazilian beverage company. And at that time, I was doing what people usually do, which is these are Brazilian companies. You should treat them as Brazilian companies. Give them an equity risk premium for Brazil. And that's what I was doing in my valuation until I opened up the Embraer annual report, and they had a pie chart of where the revenues came from. Now, what percentage of the revenues came from Brazil in 2003? 3% of the revenues came from Brazil. 97% came... You heard of Embraer, right? If you take any short flight in the U.S., you get one of those planes where you're afraid you might never make it back. And you check the way I know what type of plane I'm in, and you check to see, where are the air cushions, as if you have any chance of even pulling the air cushions out. You act under this delusion that somehow if you hit water, the air cushions are going to come out and you're going to hold on to them. This isn't Sully. You're not going to make it out of there, but still you look over it because it gives you this false sense of security. And if you look at the kinds of aircraft, Embraers are a pretty big part of that market. 97% of Embraer's revenues came from North America and Europe. 3% from Brazil. I happened to have the Boeing annual report. Don't ask me why. Okay. I opened it up, and it had a pie chart for Boeing's revenues. And Boeing got, if you look at the pie chart, I couldn't tell them apart. And here I was attaching this full equity risk premium for Brazil to Embraer and nothing to Boeing because it was a U.S. company. I said, this isn't right. I need to treat Embraer differently than Ambev. Ambev at that time was almost entirely a Brazilian beverage company. I said, I need to treat them differently. I would expect Embraer to be less exposed to Brazilian country risk than Ambev. Everybody with me on that? So it was the intuitive step. So I said, be nice if I could measure how exposed Embraer is to Brazilian country risk. So I concocted a measure. Notice the word I use, concocted. I didn't derive it. That requires deep thinking. I didn't come up with some... So basically, I made it up. Why did I call it lambda? Because I've discovered attaching a Greek letter to something gives this layer of sophistication that people don't ask questions about. So I called it lambda. So essentially what I wanted lambda to do is behave a lot like beta. I know we haven't looked at betas yet, but what's the average beta across all companies? An average risk company has a beta of 1. I wanted a lambda scaled around 1. So if you were a company that was as exposed as the average company in Brazil to Brazilian country risk, I wanted a lambda 1. If you're a company more exposed, I wanted a lambda greater than 1. And if you're less exposed, I wanted a lambda less than 1. Flight landed. I did my session in Brazil, and I threw this idea out. Wouldn't it be nice? And people in the audience kind of agreed, and then one of the people in the audience puts up his hand and he says, well, how exactly do you plan to measure this lambda? I said, I don't know yet, but I have a long flight back. And in fact, one of the papers I wrote was on that, it's on my website, you can find it, on estimating lambda. So let's think about the factors that will expose you to country risk, and you tell me whether these factors make sense to you. One is how much the company uses risk management products, right? You can insure it. So I want to know that. I want to know where your revenues are, obviously. I need to know where your factories are, your production. And I'd also like to know whether you're one of those companies that's treated as a company in the national interest, because that increases your country risk, because then governments feel the urge to kind of poke around in your business. So I said, I'd like a lambda that captures all of this. Easier said than done, but I then went looking for ways in which I could bring all of this stuff into one lambda. So I'll give you one way in which I did it, very simplistic. I looked at the revenues, just like I did in the other approach. And I'll give you an example of how this would play out. I took Tata Motors and TCS, for instance, more recently. And here's what I looked up. I looked up the percentage of revenues that Tata Motors gets in India and the percentage of revenues that Tata Consulting Services gets in India. They're both Tata Group companies. They're both Indian companies. But here's the difference. Tata Consulting Services gets about 8% of its revenues in India. Tata Motors was getting 91% of its revenues in India. The typical Indian company gets about 80% of its revenues in India. How do I know that? I just took the average across the and I could get it for only about 100 large companies, the average. Do you see where I'm going to go next? If you get 91% of your revenues in India, and the typical Indian company gets 80%, 91 divided by 80 gives me 1.14. If I take TCS, 7.62% divided by 80 gives me 0.09. So that, if I believe those numbers, Tata Motors is more exposed than the typical Indian company to Indian country risk, and Tata Consulting Services is less exposed. And here's the nice thing about this approach. This was just before Tata Motors acquired Jaguar Land Rover. The minute they acquired Jaguar Land Rover, guess what happened to the Lambda? Jaguar Land Rover, global luxury. All of a sudden, you're buying this global exposure. The Lambda went to 0.80 from 1.14. It's almost magical. But what companies do can clearly affect their country risk exposure. This approach is best used if you have an individual country you're exposed to. Because if you're exposed to 30, if you try to do this for Coca-Cola, you'll go crazy. You'll have 72 Lambdas floating around and not know what to do about them. So don't do this if you have multiple countries. But if you have one country you really want to kind of focus in on, this is a good way to do it. But it's still based on revenues. So here's the other approach I tried. You know how we estimate betas? We run a regression of returns on the stock against returns on a market index. We'll come back and talk about the limitations of that approach. But the slope of that line presumably is the beta of a stock, right? So I'm capturing how much a stock moves as the market moves. What am I trying to capture in country risk? I want to see how much my stock moves as the country moves, right? As the country gets safer and riskier. So I actually tried something that I hoped would give me that answer. I took the returns on Embraer and Embratel, two Brazilian companies. Embraer, of course, is the aerospace company, 3% of its revenues in Brazil. Embratel, at that time, was the phone company in Brazil that got all of its revenues in Brazil. It had no choice. And I ran a regression against what was called the C bond, which is actually a dollar-denominated Brazilian bond. What I'm trying to capture with that is because it's dollar-denominated, this has nothing to do with currency. It's got everything to do with how risky Brazil... So Brazil becomes riskier. The way this shows up is their dollar bond jumps. Today, if I ran this, I could run it against the CDS, which actually measures the country risk. What I'm trying to capture is when the country risk goes up, how much does my stock get affected? So if I have a company that is unaffected by country risk, when I run this regression, what should I find? The coefficient should be close to zero. My stock is not affected. If I have a company that's massively affected by country risk, for every 1% change in the country risk, I should see much bigger changes. In a sense, that's what I found. For every 1% change in country risk in Brazil, my Embraer was affected by only 0.27%, but Embratel was affected by almost 2%. So this then becomes a kind of rough proxy for the Lambda for Embraer and Embratel. So if I trust this regression, the Lambda for Embraer is 0.27. The Lambda for Embratel is 2. And those would be the numbers I would use to come up with my cost of equity for these two companies. And as I said, you can see it's a lot of work. Do it only, for most of you, this isn't going to be too much to do because it's, you know, you have too many companies you're exposed to. But if you have a single company, that's how it's going to play out. So let's kind of bring this all together because the end game here is to come up with the cost of equity. So I'll go through different ways in which people compute country risk, and you're going to see how different the answers are going to be and why it's consequential. So let's say this is 2004. You've been asked to estimate a dollar cost of equity for Embraer. So let's take currency out of the picture. The risk-free rate in U.S. dollars in 2004 was about 4%. So that becomes my base from which I'm going to build off. So 4% is my risk-free rate. I'm going to go through five different ways in which I can compute the cost of equity for Embraer. I'm going to get five very different numbers. First approach, I'm going to take the risk-free rate. The beta for Embraer was about 1.07, and I'll come and explain how I came up with that in a session or so. The equity risk premium for the U.S. was about 5%. So basically, I'm taking 1.07 times an equity risk premium for the U.S. And then I added the country risk premium for Brazil, which in 2004 was a massive number, 7.89%. So the first approach, I use what's called the bludgeon. Basically, I'm saying you're a Brazilian company. I'm going to give you the entire Brazilian country risk. You've got to kind of deal with it. I end up with a cost of equity in dollar terms of almost 17.24%. If I bring the 7.89% into the brackets, so if I treat it as a Brazilian company and give it the entire country risk, I get cost of equity of 17 to 18% in dollar terms. If I do what I talked about of estimating a lambda and breaking it out, the cost of equity I get are much slower, 9.59, 9.6, and even with the lambda approach, only 11.5%. This is something you're going to see with every emerging market company that has significant developed market exposure, right? So if I take Infosys and treat it as an Indian company, I'm going to get a much higher cost of equity than if I treat it as a company that gets 80% of its revenues outside India. So hold on to that thought. There are two ways in which you can do this. One is to do what most bankers do. Look at where you're incorporated and attach the entire country risk. The other is to kind of look at this way of at least dealing with country risk based on where you get your revenues. Let's hold everything else constant. Let's assume you have an expected cash flows. We agree on the expected cash flows. This is the only place where we disagree. Let's say the rest of the market is doing its thing. They use the 17, 18% cost of equity. You feel that the market is wrong, that they should be a little more measured and use a much lower cost of equity because Embraer gets so much of its revenues outside Brazil. So here's my question for you. And this is not just about Embraer. It's about emerging market companies that have developed market exposure. So markets treat them as emerging market companies. They tar them all with the same brush. They attach this big cost of equity and come up with a value. You've decided to use... You bought into my sales pitch and you decide to use a much lower cost of equity. You come up with a value for each of these companies. Is your value going to be higher than what the market comes up with, lower or about the same? Think about it. Same cash flows. You're using a much lower discount rate than the market. You're going to come up with a higher value. So all of these companies are going to look cheap to you, right? So carry this too. This is about making money. So what are you going to do next? You're going to go buy these companies and then do what? Hope and pray. Right? Because the reality is, the rest of the market, you can't talk them into doing... If they don't want to use lambdas, they're going to do what they... So here's my question. How do you make money off this strategy? Because to make money, what's going to happen? The market has to realize it's screwed up, right? I use the strategy all the time. I wait for a crisis in an emerging market. It's not a question of whether, it's a question of when. There's always a crisis. And when everybody abandons every stock in the market, I have a list of two or three stocks in each market, and I go in and buy, and I wait. I wait for reality to hit the market. Here's how it usually hits. The company will keep reporting earnings quarter after quarter. The country will report whether it's doing well or badly. And at some point in time, investors start noticing that the country is going through bad times. So the company seems to be reporting pretty solid earnings quarter after quarter. So this isn't just, you know, a moment of, you know, revelation. That, oh my God, we've been doing the wrong thing. It's incremental moments where the market says, maybe we've been a little unfair. That's essentially what happened at Embraer after 2004. Is quarter after quarter, Brazil will go through these contortions, but Embraer would report the earnings that it did last quarter and continue to deliver solid earnings. And at some point in time, it took about 3 years before the market said, why are we treating Embraer as a Brazilian company? It looks like a global company that happens to be incorporated in Brazil. If investing is about making money and the market is doing something that doesn't make sense, intrinsic valuation is about trying to take advantage of that mistake. But the payoff is not instantaneous because there is no moment where everything gets fixed. It will take time. There are no guarantees. But at least in my portfolio, this has been one part of my portfolio that has done remarkably well. So wait for a crisis in whichever market. Look for companies that get most of their revenues outside that market but are incorporated in that market. Wait for people to sell. They'll abandon everything. Buy these companies and sit back and wait for the reality check to kick in. It might take 2 years, it might take three, but if you're willing to be patient, eventually the truth wins out. Any questions about country risk and company risk? Yes, go ahead.
Do
That's what this is. Basically, when I do a lambda, that's basically what I'm doing. Because when I do the cost of equity for Boeing, what am I going to do now? I'm going to look at where they get their revenues. And guess what? If they get revenues in Brazil, so what you're going to see is the dollar cost of equity for global companies that compete in the same space is going to be pretty similar. Do it in the cash flows. Don't try to mess with the discount rate. If you worry about the fact that there are controls that might mean you will not get the cash flows. So remember, the discount rate is there for one reason, but the rest is still under your control. You have earnings, you have cash flows, and if you feel that there are country-specific regulations that are going to affect how you get cash flows out of the company, you can still show that. I'm not saying Embraer and Boeing are going to be valued the same. I'm just saying they'll have the same discount rate. The cash flows can be different depending on what troubles or what constraints you face. For instance, the country might have remittance restrictions. They might not allow the company to pay cash out to investors outside. You can bring that in as a cash flow constraint. That'll lower your value for the company. So this is only a part of the game. It's not the whole game. So don't try to make the discount rate carry the weight of all of those other concerns you might have about the cash flows.
And what if you're not confident about the numbers?
What makes you think I'm confident about this number? When you say confident, I would say I am never confident about a number. All I can do in valuation is do what? Make the best estimate you can with the information you have. Confidence is not a word that even comes into my vocabulary when I think about it. It's basically, this is all I know. So this is not a bond. There's a reason you get an equity risk premium, which is you're not confident. That's what an equity risk premium is, the price you're demanding. So think of it in those terms, and you will start to be able to live with that uncertainty. Okay? Because if we could be confident about our cash flows, we wouldn't be getting 6% equity risk premiums, right? So that's a payoff.
I'm not thinking about the future capital, obviously,
but
like the numbers that
you were saying,
the reporting numbers, what if
they're
not sure that those are even real
numbers? But what makes you think that Coca-Cola's accounting numbers from last year are real numbers? It's just it's a continuum. You see, they're accounting numbers. The accountant says, we made money last year. You're, in a sense, taking it as trust. You might trust some company numbers more than others. But there's no company out there where you have facts on accounting earnings. You have estimates. Yes, yeah, so that's why I'm saying, think of it as a continuum. It's a continuum in this process. But as long as you're not overestimating the numbers, what are you hoping for? You buy this 20 companies, things average out. So don't carry that burden of you want to fix every accounting problem. You're not going to be able to do it. There's nothing you can do about things that are out of your control. This is one of those things that is out of your control. Okay? So when you think about emerging market companies, keep that in mind. So now let's talk about this forward-looking way of estimating equity risk premiums. As I said, think of it just like a bond, and you're going to see exactly where I'm going to go. So I'm going to take you back to the start of 2008. Why to the start of 2008? Because I want you to see what the premium looked like pre-crisis. So here's what I did. I went and collected the S&P 500 on January 1st, 2008. So if you bought U.S. stocks on January 1st, 2008, you told me you were paying 1,468.36. That was the level of the index. On January 1st, 2008, the cash flows I expected, and these are estimates, so I could be completely wrong. I looked took the existing cash flows from the last 12 months, and I projected it out for the... And this is where this example is more complex than a dollar that I gave you, because there I gave you the expected cash flow. So here I've estimated my expected cash flows for the next 5 years. Unlike a bond, where these cash flows end at the end of 5 years or 10 years... With stocks, these cash flows go on and on and on, and I can't estimate cash flows forever. So at the end of 5 years, I stop estimating the cash flows. But I can't ignore what happens after year five. So what I assume will happen after year five is the cash flows in year five will continue to grow, because after all, these are the 500 largest market cap companies, but they will grow at the same rate as the economy. So let's see where I am. I know what you paid for stocks, 1468.36. I have my expected cash flows for the next 5 years. Beyond the fifth year, that cash flow grows at the growth rate of the economy. And at the start of 2008, my estimate for the growth rate of the economy was 4.02%. That sounds magically precise. So let me give away the secret of how I estimated that growth rate. Remember when we talked about risk-free rates, I said a risk-free rate is what? Expected inflation plus an expected real interest rate. And I also said the risk-free rate is actually a pretty good proxy for the nominal growth rate in the economy. You remember that graph I showed you, the T-bond rate against inflation and GDP growth? That's what I'm using. So beyond the fifth year, I'm assuming cash flows will continue to grow at 4.02%. So I know what you paid. I have expected cash flows. What's the only number I don't know? The discount rate, right? It's one equation, one unknown. It's messy unknown because you got these, you know, you've got raise the power 2, raise the power 3. Thank God for the solver function in Excel. Because otherwise I'd have to do it by trial and error. So what I do is I go to the solver function in Excel and say, what discount rate would I need to get the present value of my cash flows equal to 1468.36? And at the start of 2008, that discount rate I'd have needed would have been 8.39%. Let me pause right there. What does that tell me? If you bought U.S. stocks at the start of 2008, I don't care what you hoped you would make, what you prayed you would make, what you thought you would make. Given what you paid for those stocks, you expect to make 8.39% a year. You subtract out the risk-free rate of 4.02%, the equity risk premium at the start of 2008 was 4.37%. Question? Okay, that's a good question. How did I get the expected cash flows? Remember, I'm trying to act like the market. So I looked at what the market's estimates for expected growth rate were. And here, you actually get lucky because the S&P 500 is the most tracked and followed index on the face of the earth. There are actually about a dozen analysts whose job it is to project growth in earnings for the S&P 500. I took the consensus average of what they were expecting the growth rate to be. So when you look at that growth rate, that 5%, that's not my number. It's the market's expectation as I read them through the analyst forecast for future growth. So the start of every year, here's what I collect. I collect the level of the index. I look at the cash flows last year. I get this growth rate that these analysts are projecting for the S&P 500. I bring them all together. And it's not even my job to ask, are these the right numbers? If this is what you're expecting, I want to back out from your expectations what your required rate of return has to be. 4.37% would have been my equity risk premium at the start of 2008. So in February of 2008, if you asked me to value a company, I'd have used 4.37% as my risk premium for the U.S. If you're looking at Brazil or China, then I'd do the building up the way I did, but the base premium in 2008 would have been 4.38%. Now, until 2008, I used to estimate this number once every year, at the start of the year. I would use it through the entire year. So I was planning to use this 4.37% all the way through 2008. And if you'd put me on the spot, I'd have said, but this is a mature market. How much can an equity risk premium change in a mature market? And this is the way you get into trouble. Because this is 2008. And guess what? The equity risk premium changed pretty dramatically between 2008 and 2009. This is January 1st, 2009. I did exactly the same thing I did in 2008. The only difference is, remember what the S&P 500 was at the start of 2008? It was 1,468.36. This is 1 year later. The S&P 500 is 903. It had lost. That's the crisis. So the index has dropped. The cash flows dropped as well because people had gotten more pessimistic. But with the new index level and the new cash flows, I got an expected return for stocks that was slightly higher than it was the previous year, 8.64%. But see what else has changed? This is a crisis. So what happened to the T-bond rate? It dropped to 2.21%. The equity risk premium on January 1st, 2009 was 6.43%. And we know when it changed, right? In fact, it all happened in a 12-week period. So I'm going to focus in on that 12-week period where the equity... This is the largest increase in a single year for the implied equity risk premium in U.S. history. And actually, we know that the troubles started on September 12th of 2008. I remember that day. It was a Friday. I was on my way home. At 4 o'clock, why was I on the way? I just keep academic hours, which means I come in when I want. I'll leave when I want. I wanted to go home. 4 o'clock, that September 12th, 2008 was actually the day that Lehman was in trouble and there was talk about Barclays buying Lehman. So that was the news story. I remember listening to the story saying, oh, who cares, you know? Monday morning you come in, Lehman's going to drop a little, Barclays might be up a little. This isn't big market moving news. And I was incredibly wrong because on September 15th when he came in, that Monday was the start of the crisis. Because the Barclays deal fell apart, Lehman went under, and the rest, as they say, is history. So what I did for the next 12 weeks was I tortured myself. Every morning on my way into work, I would compute the implied equity risk premium at the start of the day. It's not a big deal, right? You just feed in the level of the index, you put in the cash flows. Cash flows are not moving that much on a day-to-day basis, but the index is jumping up and down. This is, see the green line here? That's actually my implied equity risk premium by day, every day from September 12th to December 31st. On September 12th, the implied equity risk premium was about 4.3%, which is actually very close to where it was at the start of the year. Everything's happening in this 12-week period. In fact, there was a day in November where the implied equity risk premium in the U.S. was 8%. Almost doubled over a four-week, six-week period. You know what my reaction as I did this on a day-to-day basis was? Never again am I going to ever estimate the implied equity risk of the U.S. at the start of every year and use it through the year. Because if you ask me how much can it change in a year, there's your answer. It can change a lot. So starting in September of 2008, I've taken to estimating the implied premium at the start of every month. The February 2017 premium is on my website on the front page. In fact, I will send it as a link to the email this afternoon so you can see what the number is. Did anybody get a chance to see that number? No, I did. I wish. No, it's 5.69%. Start of this month, it's 5.69%. You're saying, so what? All of my valuations from February, including the company valuation you're going to see tomorrow, my equity risk premium for the U.S. is going to be 5.69%. What will it be in March? I don't know. I'll redo the premium on March 1st. It's not my job to make a judgment of what a high premium was. This is a market price for risk. I should be feeding it into my valuations. And I'll give you some perspective on where the number was at the start of this year. So January 2017, the number was, if you work through the same process, the index was now 2238. Remember what it was at the start of 2009? It was like 904. So it's more than doubled. So the index is at 2238. The cash flows have also gone up. The implied equity risk premium at the start of this year was about 5.69%. So again, same process. I'm doing it for the third time with the 2017 numbers. And that's the process I repeat at the start of every month. So when you look at stocks today and you say, well, what should my equity risk premium for the U.S.? You can decide whatever you want, but the market price for equity risk in the U.S. right now is about 5.69, maybe 5.7%. That number will change as the index changes, and it's our job to essentially play out what that number will be today. The one thing that is a little troubling about the equity risk premium here is this is a number that I actually use when I look at people. There's a lot of talk about stock market bubbles right now. And part of the reason is you've had a 10-year period of stocks going up and everybody say, oh my God, is this a bubble? One way to make that judgment is to look at this premium, the 5.69%, and say, is that enough of a premium? If your answer is no, it's too low, then you have a bubble. If you say it's really high, then you have stocks being undervalued. So if you look at that number, 5.69%, is that a high number? Is that a low number? It's tough to, I've shown you 4 different years, but you know, what is it historically? This graph kind of brings home what the implied equity risk premium has looked like in the U.S. So think of what I did in 2008, 2009, 2017. Essentially think of doing that every year starting in 1960. The implied equity risk premium in the 1960s in the U.S. was between 3 and 3.5%. Markets were incredibly stable. The equity risk premium was a settled number. Then you get to the 1970s. Notice something happening? The equity risk premium is shooting up. If the equity risk premium is shooting up, what's happening to stock prices? When interest rates go up, what happens to bond prices? They go down. Equity risk premium goes up, stock. In fact, in 1978, when the equity risk premium hit 6.5%, the Dow was at 750. Think about it. There were three digits in the Dow. The Dow today is at 20,000, right? 750. Stocks were the place you didn't want to be. In fact, Fortune magazine ran a cover article saying stocks are dead. And the lesson you should get from this is that whenever Fortune and Forbes runs a headline like that, go out and buy stocks like they're going out of style. Because this was the start of the greatest bull market in U.S. equity market history, 1978 through 99. End of 99, the implied equity risk premium in the U.S. was 2%. Think about that. I'm giving you 2% more than the risk-free rate to invest in stock. What's your reaction? That's not enough, right? And when you tell me the risk premium is too low, what are you telling me about stock prices? They're too high. This was the dot-com bubble. And at that point in time, when I computed the end of that year, when I computed the implied equity risk premium, it clearly stood out. That was a number. If you told me there's a bubble, I said, you know what? Maybe you're right. The premium is really low. It's only 2%. So in 1999, if you told me there was a bubble, I could back it up. The premium is really low. Then, of course, you had the correction on that bubble. The premium bounced back to 4%. It stayed around 4% for about 5 years. Then you get the crisis, and the premium jumps again. And since 2008, the two things that have become the characters of the premium is they're higher than they were pre-crisis, and they've become a lot more volatile. So when you think about valuing stocks, the old days you could just use 4%, get away with it, continue to use it all the time. Now you've got to be more responsive to the world around you because the price of risk is changing on a pretty dramatic basis. So if you want to see the monthly premiums, there are three ways you can do it. I'm going to send you the spreadsheet and you do it yourself. It's a very simple spreadsheet. You put the S&P 500, you back into, you know, it uses a solver function. Basically, I take you through every step. Try it out. It's not much work. You just update the, so you can do it as of today. So put in the S&P 500 as of 4 p.m. today. Put in the T-bond rate. So basically, you can pull this off the Wall Street Journal website. Run the solver function. You can get an implied equity risk premium as of today. So that's the first. That takes a little work. If you're a little too lazy to do that, then you can go to my website. On the front page, I actually do the update. So you'll get at least the start of the month update. If you're too lazy to even do that, I'll have it. I have a third option, and I, you know, you might consider that you have to thank my daughter for this. And it, you know, it was about 5 or 6 years ago. I was sitting in my small part of our house. I won't call it an office because I really don't have one. So I'm minding my own business. My daughter busts in. She never used to walk in or waltz in. She just busted in. Said, "Dad, you have a Twitter account." I said, "Kendra, I don't have a Twitter account." She says, "Dad, you're so old. Why you'd state the obvious and then walk out? I don't know." She walks out. I'm pissed off. So how difficult can it be to get a Twitter account? So I go and I open a Twitter account. I do nothing. A few months later, she busts into my corner of the house again and says, "Dad, you know you have 1,000 followers on Twitter." So what the hell are they following? I've never Twitter tweeted nothing. They're following somebody who never tweets. So I go in, there are 1,000 people following somebody who never tweets. I said, "This isn't right. If there are people following me, I have to give them something to follow." So start of every month, guess what I tweet out? The equity risk premium for the S&P 500 just is 5.69%. See, if you were on my Twitter follower list, you'd have found out what the equity risk premium is. This is my unvarnished attempt at getting your names on my Twitter follower list. I tell my kids, my revenge on my kids is I'm always going to have more Facebook followers than they do. Facebook friends, I guess. More Twitter followers than they do. So help me out here. So go in, add your names to the list, push up the numbers. Let's see what we can do, right? As I said. And you will get, as a bonus, the equity risk premium at the start of every month. Right? So at least for this class, why don't you do it? And then you can block me. One final thing about the equity risk premium at the start of the year. I told you that was 5.69%. But one of the troubling things about the equity risk premium at the start of the year is, if you remember, the starting point for my equity risk premium is the cash flow that stocks generated last year. And I compute that cash flow by looking at dividends paid and stock buybacks on U.S. companies. That number was 108.67 at the start of 2017. So in the 12 months leading into January 1st, 2017, the S&P 500 stocks returned about 108. You're saying, so what? That 108.67 was actually higher than the dividend, the earnings. The earnings for the S&P 500 was only 102. So last 12 months leading into 2017, U.S. companies were returning more than their earnings in dividends and buybacks, and that is not sustainable. Why? Because at some point in time, you're going to eat through your earnings, and if you want to grow and you're not putting money back, it's going to catch up with you. So starting about a year ago, when this problem became apparent, I computed kind of a reworked version of the implied equity risk premium. But I started with what they pay. I can't change that. But rather than let that number grow at the same rate as earnings, I essentially computed what they could afford to pay. I'll come back and talk about this a little more when we talk about growth. But essentially, if I'm going to assume that U.S. stocks are going to grow 2.45% a year, they have to reinvest to grow. I compute what they can pay out, which in this case is about 82.3%. So it's what I'm doing is I'm starting with their existing cash flows, and I'm saying, but those cash flows are probably going to come under pressure because they're paying out too much. So it's a more conservative way of computing the implied premium. And the number that I get is, for the implied equity risk premium now, if I do that adjustment, is about 4.5%. That's lower than the 5.69%. But guess what? If I look at history, 4.5% is still pretty good. This is in 1999. We're not at a 2% premium. No matter how you slice it, the way stocks are priced is not red flag time. It's not bubble time. Clearly, you can have concerns, but it's not. The premium is not low enough for me to say, you know what, maybe we should head for the hills. You know, sell off stocks, we'll come back in about 6 months or a year. There's a correction coming. It's not that kind of equity risk premium. So that's why I compute this on a monthly basis, partly to use in my valuation and partly for me to be able to observe red flags when they start to happen. So in March, I look at the equity risk premium, goes to 4.3%, then 4.1%, then 3.9%. I'm starting to get a little worried because the historic average over the last 50 years has been about 4.1%. So as the premium keeps dropping, if it continues to drop below that historical average, maybe it's time for me to start to get worried about our stocks collectively being misvalued. Question?
Should there be any difference between calculating the implied risk premium and then using the cost benefit of buying the S&P?
You could. In fact, you get exactly the same answer if you take the earnings to price and you do it right. Because this is basically an earnings to price ratio. All to get converted to an earnings to price, all I have to do is divide all the way through. But you can't just take the earnings to price itself and use it as a cost of equity because you're ignoring growth and you're ignoring cash flows. Yeah.
The only other problem is that if the implied equity risk ratio, are the analysts ever going to say that the growth is going to be the growth assumption in their terminal value?
But the big thing is not the growth assumption, it's a cash flow assumption. I can live with the growth being off, but that's why I worried more about the cash flows and the growth rate. Because this is a mature market. The growth can be 5.5, maybe 3.5, it can even be 1%. It doesn't affect my risk premium as much as getting the cash flow wrong. So I'm more worried about those cash flows being unsustainable than about the growth being off. Right? So if you ask me what an equity risk premium for the U.S. is right now, I'll say 4.5 to 6%. I can defend that range. And it's a pretty tight range relative to that historical premium where I could get plus or minus, you know, 0 to 9%. So that's the reason I stay focused on implied premiums. It keeps me kind of looking at the numbers and being honest about what that price of risk is and building in my valuation. Any questions? Okay. Couple of added. So here's what I'm going to do. Because I can get this forward-looking premium every year, and it changes over time, I can start to ask questions. Why does it increase in some years? Why was the, for instance, when I showed you the 1970s, remember the premium was incredibly high? It climbed. What happened in the 1970s that made my equity risk premium for the U.S. so high? Now, what was the triggering factor, you think, for rising price for risk? You were going to say something.
The oil crisis,
but the oil crisis by itself precipitated what in the U.S.? Something we'd never seen in a long time. We had inflation in the double digits. For the first time in U.S. market history, going back to the Civil War, we had double-digit inflation. You're saying, so what? Inflation is deadly for stocks. It's deadly for stocks because it's uncertain. A 10% inflation rate can go to 2 or 18. And when you feel there's more risk in stocks, what do? You increase the price of risk. So in the 1970s, the reason for high risk premiums are high inflation and high interest rates. That wasn't the reason in 2008, right? 2008, the risk-free rate was low. Inflation was non-existent. There the worry was, hey, how will this crisis play out in banks on the rest of the economy? So the kinds of things that caused risk premiums to rise in the 70s were very different from the kinds of things that caused them to rise in 2008. So here's what I did first. I decided to look at how much the equity risk premium was given the risk-free rate. And here's my hypothesis. When you have a 15% risk-free rate, I would expect you to demand a much higher risk premium than when you have a 2% risk-free rate. Do you see why? If you have a 2% risk-free rate, you demand a 6% premium. That's 2 plus 6 is 8. When you get a 15% risk-free rate, my guess is you're probably going to demand a higher premium because on a proportional basis. So I said, is that true? So I went back and looked at, in this case, 1960 to 2016 data, where the blue line is the risk-free rate and the red on top is the equity risk premium. So there are the 1970s, and you can see in the 1970s, the reason for risk premiums climbing is that the risk-free rate is climbing. But if you take out the 70s, in the U.S., the relationship between risk-free rates and risk premiums is very weak. In other words, there doesn't seem to be any strong relationship outside of the 70s between risk-free rates and risk premiums. So here's how I'd summarize this graph. If you see hyperinflation in the U.S., I'd expect to see equity risk premiums rise. 8%, 10%, 12% inflation, I would expect to see equity risk premiums climb. But if you see risk-free rates go from 2% to 4%, I don't expect some massive shift because at least based on history, it doesn't seem to vary that much within that small range on risk-free rates. So that's the first thing I looked at. So what's the equity risk premium again? It's the price of risk in the equity market, right? Now I go to the corporate bond market. Is there a way I can measure the price of risk in the corporate bond market? Or how do we measure the price of risk in the corporate bond market? Default spreads. Basically, you take the corporate bond rate and you can subtract out the risk-free rate or defaults, the total bond rate. And so we look at default spreads of the bond market. Do you think the two markets should be connected? In other words, when the price of risk is rising in the equity market, should the price of risk generally also be rising in the bond market? Remember, they're same investors often in both markets, right? If people are getting freaked out in one market, how can they not be getting freaked out in the other market? Most of the time, you'd expect that when equity risk premiums go up, bond default spreads are also going to go up. So I said, okay, let's see if that's true. I know this is a very difficult graph to read, so I'll take you through the three lines. The blue line is the implied equity risk premium. It's the same graph you saw just a few minutes ago. The black line is the default spread on a BAA rated bond. So I picked one ratings class so that I could see the price of risk change over time. Okay. So there's the blue line, equity risk premium. Black line is the BAA default spread. This bar here is the ratio of the two. So I divide the equity risk premium by the bond. So to see how much higher the equity risk premium is than the bond default spread. The average across the entire 55-year time period was about 2. The equity risk premium is about twice the bond default spread. So the bond default spread is 3%. The equity risk premium tends to be 6%, which makes sense. Equities are riskier than bonds. Most of the time, the two move together. When the bond default spread rises, the equity risk premium goes up. When people are freaked out in one market, they're freaked out in the other, with two very, very clear exceptions. The first was in the late 90s. If you take a look at the late 90s, here's the bond default spread. It's actually climbing. There's the U.S. equity risk premium. It's dropping. It's a dot-com boom. The price of equity risk actually ends up being lower than the price of a BAA rated bond. Is a pretty safe bond. I'm actually getting a 2% spread on a BAA rated bond and a 2% equity risk premium at the same market. Think like an investor. You can put your money in bonds, very safe bonds, and get a 2% spread. Or you can put your money in stocks, very risky stocks, and get a 2%. At the end of 99, this seems like a no-brainer, right? You'd have taken your money out of stocks. And if you had, you'd have saved yourself a lot of losses because that was, of course, the starting of the unraveling of the dot-com boom. All I'm saying is when you compare those two prices of risk, you're getting a sense of one market being mispriced relative to the other. At the end of 99, stocks were being massively overpriced relative to bonds. Move forward a couple of years. So now you're at 2001. 9/11 happens, and Alan Greenspan says, I will not let the U.S. equity markets or the U.S. economy go into recession. The hubris of central bankers. over the next few years, you see the results of what's called the Greenspan put, where he stepped in to the bond market and he basically gave an assist to the bond market. And here's how it showed up. See those default spreads for bonds? What are they doing? They're dropping. The equity risk premium stays high. So now you have equity risk premium staying high, the bond market essentially having a lower and lower price for risk. That's from 2003 all the way through 2007. We often talk about the 2008 crisis, right? We talk about the big... Did you see, guys, see The Big Short? It all made it look like it was a house... Isn't that a great movie to watch, right? So made it look like it was a housing... And, of course, you've heard it described as a subprime crisis. I'll cut to the heart of what caused the 2008 crisis. It wasn't that you were lending to subprime borrowers. There's nothing wrong with that. That's a pretty solid business. As long as you lend at the right rate. The heart of the 2008 problem was in the bond market where people were lending money and not charging a high enough default spread for it. They were able to get away with it, as you can see, for an extended period. And then you get to 2008, and what do you see with both numbers? Default spreads shoot up. Why? Because people are going, oh my God, there's default risk in this room, no matter what the models tell us. And it dragged the equity market down with it, both the equity risk premium and default spreads go up. The story I'm trying to tell you is we often get into echo chambers. When you go to work, you end up in the equity market, and all you think about is the equity market and equity risk premium. So you go into the bond market, and all you think about is the bond market. I think we live in a world where we have too many specialists. We have equity specialists, we have bond specialists. They don't even talk to each other. Because if they'd been talking to each other, in 1999, they'd have known there was a problem. In 2007, they'd have known there was a problem. But because they weren't talking to each other, it looked perfectly okay within the bond market, because what do you have to compare it against? So one advantage of being able to put these numbers on the same page is at least you can start to get a sense of when things stop making sense, when the numbers are going in different directions. So we looked at equity risk premiums and risk-free rates. We looked at equity risk premiums and bond default spreads. Price of risk in the bond market, price of risk in the equity market. But we talked about housing as the real, as one of the core culprits, right, in 2008. Is there a price of risk in the housing market? Anybody worked in real estate before? You know what a cap rate is in real estate? Have you heard of this? It's called a capitalization rate. Basically, it's a rate that real estate developers use to decide what to pay for a property. So if your cap rate is 10% and a property has $1 million in income, the pricing of the property would be $1 million divided by 0.10, which will give you $10 million. So cap rate is like a cost of equity in real estate. And it's actually a number that's widely, it's a public number, you can look it up. So when people get optimistic about real estate, the cap rate gets lower, and they get pessimistic, it gets higher. So here's what I'm going to do in my final graph. I have the equity risk premium and the bond default spread from the previous graph on the columns. And in this line over here, I've graphed out the difference between the cap rate and the risk-free rate. So if your cap rate is 7%, the risk-free rate is 3%, I'm going to call that a real estate risk premium. So I've tried to bring a third market in. And there's a very interesting story you can see being told if you start tracking the real estate risk premium. Prior to 1992, what does the real estate risk premium look like? It looks like a negative number, right? You're saying, why would I accept that? I remember when I did my MBA, we were told that if you invest in stocks and bonds, you should add real estate to your portfolio. It's a good way to diversify your risk, because real estate moves in the opposite direction as financial assets. That was a conventional wisdom. And it was actually true. In the early 80s, the 70s, real estate actually moved. So if your stocks did badly, your real estate did well. You see where I'm going to go next? If you're an investor who invests primarily in stocks and bonds, you add real estate to your portfolio, you know how much risk you add? Actually, you reduce the risk of your portfolio because it moves in the opposite direction as everything else. So the 80s, that's what you saw. You actually got a negative risk premium in real estate because it was making your portfolio less risky. So you were told, go buy a house, invest in rental properties. We listened too well because we started investing in real estate. In fact, because it was so inconvenient to invest in actual real estate, we asked people to securitize real estate for us so we could buy mortgage-backed securities, pieces of real estate. And this is, I think, something we need to think about whenever we think about securitization. As you start to securitize an asset class, guess what starts to happen to it? It starts to behave more like stocks and bonds. So starting in the 90s, see what's happening? The risk premium for real estate is starting to look a lot like the risk premium for stocks and bonds, with many of the ups and downs coming at the same time. So here's how it's going to manifest itself. 2008, at the end of the year, you're an investor, you look at your stocks. What do you see? Carnage, down 40%. You look at your bonds, what do you see? Carnage, down 30%. You say, okay, I have real estate, thank God for that. You look at your house, what do you see? Carnage, down 30% as well. Now do you see why people are terrified when investing? There are no safe places left. Real estate is not going to provide you the protection it did 20 or 30 years ago, because in a sense we've destroyed that protection by securitizing it and making it behave more like stocks and bonds. It's actually something we need to start thinking about when we think about how do we create investment portfolios, because I think as asset classes start to move together, you're going to see this happen. Risk premiums and all the markets are going to move together. And that's part of the reason you might want to be aware of not just the equity risk premium, but keep an eye on the bond default spread. It's an easy number to track. I'll send you a link where you can track it on a monthly basis or even a daily basis if you want. And I'll give you a link for the real estate so you can check out the cap rate so you can see how the numbers move, because that's something we as investors need to take, you know, ownership of, thinking about what those numbers are. Any questions about equity risk premiums and why they move over time? So I do this in investment banks all the time, and they're very stuck in their ways. They like doing things the way they have. So, you know, a few months ago, I was actually at an investment bank, and I was talking about implied premiums, and they used historical premiums. That's the way they did all their valuations. So there were about 30 bankers in the room. At the end of the session, the managing director for equity research came to me and said, you know what, I hear what you're saying about implied premiums being different from historical premiums, but I don't think we have a problem. And I said, why? He said, we all use the same premium. So let me kind of rephrase with numbers what he was talking about. He said, we use a historical premium, and we'll base it off this table. Let's say that historical premium from the table is 7.96%. We all use 7.96% in a market where the implied premium is 5.69%. So every equity research analyst, let's say they're doing discounted cash flow valuation, they're all using the 7.96% premium when the premium in the market is 5.69%. Tell me what each of these analysts is going to, as they go through value company after company, when they're using an 8% premium and the market's building in a 5.96% premium, as they value company after company, what are they going to find with every company they're valuing? You're using a really high premium, so your discount rate's going to be really high. You use a really high discount rate, your value is going to be really low. You're going to find stocks overvalued, stocks overvalued, stocks overvalued, stocks over, every single stock, right? If you do your DCF right. And why are you finding every stock to be overvalued? Because you think the market is overvalued. The minute you use a premium that's different from today's implied premium, you're taking a view about markets into every company valuation that you do. So if you used a 4% risk premium today, I can already predict you what you're going to find. Your stock's going to look really cheap, not because it's a good stock to buy, but because you think the S&P 500 is undervalued. So basically what you're doing when you use a premium different from the current implied premium is you're building in a market view into every single company that you value, and that's not a good idea. So that's one final reason why these implied premiums should be tracked and used, because if you start to deviate from those implied premiums, you're going to end up with strange-looking valuations for your company. So when you turn in your DCF valuation, one of the numbers I'm going to check is your equity risk premium. If you're using a 3% equity risk premium, I already know what I'm going to see at the bottom, right? You're going to find the stock to be really cheap, but I'm not going to go through the rest of your assumptions. I'm just going to point to your equity risk premium and say, price this at a reasonable price, then we can talk about whether your company is cheap or expensive, because this is not your number or my number to set. It's a price of risk in the equity market. So at the start of every year, I do this kind of long paper on equity risk, because this is a fundamental number everybody uses, so I kind of look at the historical premium, I do my implied premium, I compare. So everything you've seen, I've kind of put together a paper, and if you're interested, I'll send you the link to that as well. But at the end of the paper, I end with a question, because ultimately this is a pragmatic question. You want to do a valuation with an equity risk premium that you think is the right premium. And what's the right premium? In my view, your equity risk premium is the right premium if it's a better predictor of what actually happens in stocks in the future, right? That's the whole idea. That's what you're trying to estimate. So I look at all these different ways of computing. I take the historical premium, the implied premium, multiply the BAA spread by 2, basically different proxies. And I look to see which ones give me the best predictor of what actually happens in the next 10 years. My view, the better the predictor, the better the premium works. So let's go through. The best estimate of next year's equity risk premium is just the current implied premium. So if you ask me, what are stocks going to do over the next year? That 5.69% that I have right now turns out to be the best predictor of what will stocks do over the next year. With returns over the next 5 years, it does pretty well, but there smoothing out the implied premium seems to do a slightly better job. You know what I mean by smoothing out? Rather than just use the last month, I might use the last 5 years, something to get an average. But if I look at the returns over the next 10 years, that smoothing out seems to work even better. So basically, the further out you go, the more there's an argument for, hey, let's look at a smoothed out average of that implied premium. Rather than 5.69%, that might be 5.4% if I look at the last 5 years. But that is my rationale for using the implied premium. Now, do you see why I don't use the historical premium? If you're thinking about a bad way of estimating what stocks will do in the next year, the next 5 years, the next 10 years, the historical premium would be it. It's actually negatively correlated. When that number is a high number, I actually earn lower returns in the future. When that number is a low number, I earn high returns. And you can see why. After crises, that number becomes a low number. So historical premiums are actually the worst. In fact, if push comes to shove, I'd rather just take the default spread on a BAA-rated bond, multiply by 2, and move on. I'll do a better job getting the equity risk premium than using a historical premium. So don't let the equity risk premium just become a number you plug and chug with. This is a number that should make you think about, what do I think about equity markets? Where are they going? Because that's what the implied equity risk premium is telling me about stocks. One final advantage of an implied premium. In last session, we did talk a lot about getting these country risk premiums. Remember the elaborate concoction I had to went through, default spread, no, I adjusted it for the risk of equity. One nice thing about implied equity risk premiums is I can compute them for an emerging market. This is actually my estimate of the implied equity risk premium for the Sensex, the Indian market, in September of 2007. So basically, I took the level of the index, just like I did for the S&P 500, I projected the cash flows for the next 5 years and beyond and solved for the discount rate, exactly like the S&P 500. The implied premium for India in September of 2008 would have been about 4.46%. It's a different way of thinking about risk that doesn't require to use ratings and default spreads. One of these days, I hope to be able to compute implied equity risk premiums for every country you saw in that picture, the globe. I'm not there yet. There's too much missing data. But it's a number you can track over time. And in fact, I'll close with this graph. This is actually a graph for Brazil that I do every year, where I compute the implied premium. And for those of you who've been following what's happening in Brazil, the last couple of years, you're seeing risk jump up, and you're seeing that captured in the implied premiums. So let's stop there. On Wednesday, we will start talking about betas. If you can pick your company, here's what I'd like you to bring on Wednesday with you. If you can pick your company, find a Bloomberg terminal. There's, I think, one in the basement. And type in the word beta. You'll get a beta page for your company. I'll send you the full directions. Try to bring that beta page to class with you, because it's going to be a good way for you to start thinking about, hey, what should I be using as a beta for my company? Okay? Well, it's in there. You know how it shows up? What's that last term in my DCF equation? It's a perpetuity, a growing perpetuity, right? That's actually my expected price 5 years out. You can't have your cake and eat it too. I can't count the price appreciation every year and count the terminal price. So in the DCF, that's what a terminal value is.
Terminal value calculates the capital appreciation.
Expected price appreciation.
In the next 5 years.
Beyond the 50th.
Beyond the 50th.
Because you can't get the price certification in the next 5 years because you sell off the stock, you can't get the cash flow next year. That's why you can't count the cash flow. Otherwise, you can't count the cash flow. So if you want to show the cash flow, you have to hold the stock. If you hold the stock, you can't get the price appreciation until you sell.
Yeah?
The other side, the cash flows, expected cash flows.
So let's say S&P, like today I take the index of that, and the other side has the cash flow.
The stock, the companies in the index, so these come from the earnings and the cash flows, right? No, the cash flow is not equal. The present value of the cash flows, that's in the discounted cash flow valuation. The value of an asset is the present value of the expected cash flows, right? So the level of the index is what you're paying for stock. So basically, this is what I mean. If this is an intrinsic valuation,
I thought on the other side, it should be
cash flow. Cash flows into the cash flow.
Yeah,
you pay for something, you get cash flow.
Right?
So basically, it is a cash flow from you, right? You get the index. That's what your negative cash flow is up front. Is you pay the money to get the index. That's you paying the cash flow. Now that you have the index, I pay you cash flow.
It's not that the units are different.
The units are all S&P 500 units.
Are the same?
Yeah.
Units?
They're all the same units. They've done the S&P 500 units.
This is about the weekly challenge.
Yep.
Here you mentioned like, so for this, I think for E, you add this 12, you say that's an important variable. Do you think, like, why should I add this to cash flow to equity? Because, like...
Because if you borrow money, what happens? Just think in terms of cash in, you cash out. You borrow money. Cash comes into the company, cash leaves the company. That's what the problem is. You're borrowing money because as you're growing, you're covering some of your capex with debt.
You borrow money. You have more to give to everyone.
Exactly.
I thought, because I have another explanation, it's because I have to borrow to pay dividends.
Well, it doesn't matter. Money is fungible. So let's assume it's $30 in capex, right? If I don't borrow, what's happening? The entire $30 is covered with equity. Equity investors have to come up with the money. And if your debt ratio stays stable, that can't be right. Because if I keep reinvesting money,